The Vietnam War cost Americans 55,000 lives. World War I, 116,000 American lives. World War II, 405,000 American lives. These are big numbers. And yet there is another war that's raging every day that's claiming many more casualties than that. It makes all these wars pale in comparison. And it's all happening on American soil. In this war, people do not always lose their physical lives, yet the end result remains the same. With each casualty, the present generation loses its ability to resist the enemy. It becomes weaker and weaker, and actually faces its own extinction. The enemy is not a foreign enemy. The enemy is not a terrorist cell trying to get through airport security. The enemy is not secret mercenaries. The enemy is Satan himself, and he's far more sinister and effective than many people give him credit for. And yet he's so subtle and persuasive, many people unwittingly allow him entrance into their own home without even realizing it. We're going to be looking at some sobering statistics of this unseen war. Just because this war is unseen doesn't mean it's not real. I think people sometimes get it in their head that if it's unseen, it's pretend. It doesn't have any effect. This war is most certainly real. And this war does most certainly cause great damage. And there are casualties in this war. And perhaps you have seen some of those casualties yourself. 50% of all marriages in America end in divorce. The average age for men is 30. The average age for women is 29 in those divorces. 67% of all second marriages end in divorce. 70 to 73% of all third marriages end in divorce. In other words, it doesn't get better, it gets worse. 40% of all divorces involve children. In other words, people who sever their marriages, handing this problem down to their children in one form or another. The effects of those things are long-term, far-reaching, and devastating. I speak with experience. I am a child of a divorced family. I understand the damage that is caused through that and how long it takes to try to overcome that. As of 2005, there are 14 million single-parent families in the United States, 83% of which are headed by women. There are 21 million children in these single-parent families that are without proper leadership. Every night, enough teenagers to fill the Rose Bowl, Cotton Bowl, Sugar Bowl, Orange Bowl, Fiesta Bowl, and Super Bowls combined average attendance will prostitute themselves for money and drugs in American cities tonight. There are 1 million American teenage girls who will be pregnant out of wedlock this year. 500,000 of those will abort those pregnancies. The United States, for being as advanced as it is among other nations, has the highest percentage of teen pregnancies in the Western industrialized world that costs this country $7 billion a year in expenses. 60% of all church-involved teenagers are sexually active. 66% of all high school seniors have used illegal drugs. In 2005, 10% of all 12 to 17-year-olds are habitual illicit drug users. Teen alcohol abuse and addiction is rampant. By the time they are high school seniors, 80% I should say, of teenagers will have used alcohol, 80%. 62% of teenagers will have been drunk at one time or another. 28% of all 15 to 20-year-old drivers who were killed in auto accidents had been drinking. Every 78 seconds, a teen in America attempts suicide, and suicide is the third leading cause of death among teens. And I think what is the saddest and worst statistic of all, 85% of all children raised in Christian families will leave the Lord and the church by age 20. Tell me there's no war going on right now, and that this war isn't decimating our American families. It's pretty sober stuff. And how many people are being lost as a result of the success of this campaign of Satan's? These are depressing statistics. And yet they indicate just how deeply this unseen war has permeated our society, and yes, even our churches. The question this morning is, husbands and wives, what are you doing to keep from being a divorce or broken home statistic? What are you doing to prevent that? If you think that your marriage is going to survive just because you and your wife or you and your husband are Christians, you should take note. The divorce rate among Christians, and I realize that Christians is a broad term here as statistics go, but the divorce rate among Christians is nearly as high as the national average, and is actually far higher than that among atheists and agnostics. Donald Hughes, in his book, Divorce Reality, says, in the churches, people have a superstitious view that Christianity will keep them from divorce, but they are subject to the same problems as everyone else, and these include a lack of relationship skills. In other words, religious beliefs do not provide immunity against failure. I'm not suggesting this morning at all that no one's working on their marriage, and yet, by observation alone, in general, weak and problematic marriages seem to far outnumber healthy, strong, Christ-centered ones. Another question, fathers and mothers, what are you doing to keep your children from becoming one of those ugly statistics that I read earlier? What are you doing to prevent your children or perhaps your grandchildren from being on those lists? I'm not asking you what are the elders doing or what is the preacher doing or the Bible class teachers or the school or daycare. I'm asking, what are you doing to keep your children from being just another casualty in this brutal war? If you wait until your children are teenagers to train them and educate them and teach them about the Lord, you have virtually handed them over to the enemy, because that is far too late to do so. Once again, I'm not suggesting that nothing is being done. Thankfully, we have a number of concerned and active parents in the Lord who are bringing up their children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And yet for every one of those families, there are many more who are not paying attention, who are busy and distracted with their own lives, who are so self-absorbed with their own situations that the children are expendable. Most children are being mentally prepared and mentally conditioned to leave the Lord years before college age, as early as elementary and middle school. And the common reasons I'll put up here on the screen. They are taught to believe in the Darwinian evolution explanation for the existence of the world. God is irrelevant. Creation is a joke. Evolution is a fact. You say, that's not true. It doesn't matter that it's not true. That's what they're being taught. They are being taught that the Bible is in contradiction to science, and that science, and especially evolution, is based upon facts and evidence, and the Genesis account of creation is based upon blind and mindless faith. The public education system and nearly all the media that is bombarding our children with propaganda comes from godless, liberal, humanistic people, humanistic in their content and in their conclusions. This same system teaches that homosexuality is acceptable, perhaps even superior to heterosexuality, that same-sex marriages are constitutionally protected rights, that abortion is part of family planning, premarital sex is a healthy part of self-discovery, and so on. The same Christian parents who assume that their children will be saved because they go to church and read the Bible and don't associate with bad kids, some of these same parents are actually training their children to be converted to the church rather than to the Lord, and it will show in those children's later lives. The point here that I'm making is that you cannot afford to assume that you are immune or exempt because you are a Christian or because you have a Christian marriage. You cannot afford to assume that your children or grandchildren will not succumb to Satan's attacks just because they are, at least presently, sitting on the pew next to you. You cannot afford to assume that Satan is going to leave your family alone because you go to church and you have Bibles tucked under your arms and so on. The more unsuspecting you are because of such naive beliefs, the more vulnerable and gullible you will be to the enemy's lies. And that's why we had 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1 through 12, read prior to this lesson. It ends with, if anyone thinks that he stands, take heed that he does not fall. But if you go in the first 11 verses there of that chapter, what Paul is saying is, Israel had every opportunity. They were baptized, just like you Christians. They were baptized differently, but they were baptized in the sea. They had God's miracles. They had God's providence. They had everything handed to them, everything to make them successful. And they were not successful because they turned away from all that they were given. And don't think it will be any different for you or me, is the message that Paul leaves us with. If you think you stand, take heed. Satan does not care that we call ourselves Christians. He does not care that we meet on Sunday. He does not care that we sing songs of praise to God. He does not care that we pray prayers and earnest compassion for other people. He is assaulting us and our children anyway with soul-destroying weapons. And in war, not everyone survives. You've got to take this seriously. Satan has essentially two objectives. First of all, split the marriage. Secondly, split the family. He targets Christian marriages and Christian families because he already has the others. Satan may not play fair, but he's not unintelligent. He knows that if he can divide the leadership of the family, it's just a matter of time before he takes control of the children. And the more children that he controls, the more that he controls of society and the nation in the years to come. This is not rocket science, people. We should know this. And we should be very much aware of this. In 1933, Adolf Hitler says, "When an opponent declares, 'I will not come over to your side,' I calmly say, 'Your child belongs to us already. What are you? You will pass on. Your descendants, however, now stand in the new camp. In a short time, they will know nothing else but this new community.'" These are words that Satan himself could say. Satan uses the same logic and the same strategy, and it's very effective. Don't think that just because you've held on to your beliefs for so many years that somehow that's going to trickle down to the next generation by itself, and that they're going to believe what you believe just because you believed it. That your children and grandchildren's convictions will be exactly what yours are just because you've held them for so long and because you can passionately defend them. That's not good enough by itself. We are facing this very problem today in the brotherhood. Every new generation is increasingly godless and biblically illiterate. I'm not pointing fingers at any specific people. I'm talking about a generation, an attitude, trends that we're seeing in the church. We're not seeing people get more and more devoted to God. We're seeing them getting less and less devoted. We're not seeing them being more and more devoted to the Word and more knowledgeable of it. We're seeing less and less of it. Every decade that goes by, we see less and less of it. Today, trial marriages and living together is becoming increasingly popular, more than ever in the history of America. It is the product of the me-first generation that is seemingly terrified of commitment, yet wants all the perks and advantages of commitment. Watch any chick flick on TV or the movies today, and you will see this unapologetically advertised. People writhing their hands in angst over, "I don't know if we should get married," but jumping at the chance to move in together, having sex together, and all of those other things. They don't even blink at that. It's just part of the culture. It's just what people do. In 2005, there are 5.4 million people in America living together. Think of the effect that that is having on our nation. Over 80% of all couples who are living together will not last as a couple, or if they marry, they will divorce. Over 80%. Over 50% of these are more likely divorced than those who do not live together. Children whose parents are living to, or a parent rather, is living with a non-parent in a trial marriage situation are 3 times more likely to get pregnant out of wedlock or expelled from school. They are 5 times more likely to be in poverty by adulthood. They are 10 times more likely to be abused by the step-parent than by the biological parent. And they are 22 times more likely to be incarcerated. Now, if you start multiplying this out and extrapolating these children who are brought up in these scenarios, and that's the only life that they know, and then they go and they do the same thing, and then their children go and they do the same thing, can you see where this number goes? It just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and the destruction keeps getting worse and worse. As the numbers grow and the statistics increase, more and more irreversible damage is being done to the social fabric of this nation, putting tremendous strain on the schools, the churches, the law enforcement, the system. We are feeling the effects of that today. We've been feeling it for a while, but we're just simply recognizing that we are feeling the effects of that today. Many young people marry today with the idea of, well, if it doesn't work, we can always divorce. And for that reason, they keep their his and her stuff separated, including his and her friends, in case they ever need to be separated again. They keep their options open. The husband stays in touch with an old flame. The wife clings desperately to her career, you know, just in case. Each spouse privately has a fallback plan, an exit strategy, some kind of written or non-written prenup agreement. Every fight threatens to be the big one, you know, the one that forces the breach or the one from which that relationship will never recover. Separations are temporary, overnight, a few days, and then they become routine, and then they become permanent. And meanwhile, the children in those relationships live in fear that their parents are going to be the next ones to join all the other kids' parents at school, and that they'll just become another statistic. And you can see where this all goes. We start multiplying all these families that are trained to think of marriage in this way, trained to think that divorce is an acceptable, viable alternative, trained to think that marriage is expendable if two people just can't work things out, etc. How Christians view marriage has a great deal of insight, or provides a great deal of insight, on how those people view God and His authority. Since marriage is a God-given institution, any trivializing of it or any assault against it is a trivializing or an assault against God Himself. Someone says, well, I don't trivialize marriage. Well, that's excellent if you don't. But you realize that if you do not live like a Christian husband or a Christian wife, then you are trivializing marriage. And furthermore, if God has said that I hate divorce, which He has said in Malachi 2:16, and yet you or I choose divorce as a viable option, what does that say about our respect for God? People don't want to admit it, but their actions speak far louder than words. Just as congregations do not function on autopilot, they do not succeed by accident, neither does marriage. It's something you have to work at. And yeah, sometimes it's really hard. Just because you've been married a long time does not mean automatically that your marriage serves as a model example to others. Even ungodly people can marry for life, and yet they remain ungodly and poor examples. Don't think that endurance by itself is a measure of success. You know, we often focus on the great harm done upon the church when Christians divorce, and it is a great harm, there's no question. But just as devastating is the harm done from stale, unproductive, uninspiring, and dysfunctional marriages. In other words, just because you and your spouse do not divorce does not mean you're contributing to the work of the kingdom. Don't think that just because you're married and someone else is divorcing, that you're better than them, or that your marriage is a better scenario than their divorce, if indeed your marriage isn't doing anything. You see, I'm trying to break down these myths and these misperceptions that we might have here. In the same vein, if you think, well, okay, I admit my marriage is not so great, but at least I have great children, you are forgetting there that your children are observing your pathetic marriage, if indeed that's what it is, and may imitate that in their own marriage, and will simply perpetuate the cycle for generations to come. The point is not here, we're doing it all wrong. The point here is instead, if we're not careful, any of us can do this wrong. And all of us can do better. Christ deserves our very best. Our very best as husbands, as wives, as mothers and fathers, as children. He deserves our very best. Whether you're giving him your best or not, that's between you and Christ right now. My point is, what the Bible teaches is that he deserves our very best. And in order to do better and to seek the very best, especially in the realm of marriage and family, that requires some things, some action on your part, some things that you have to do. First of all, you have to take an honest inventory of where you are at. In 2 Corinthians 13, verse 5, Paul challenges the Corinthians. He says, test yourself, examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. And we often look at this as a negative thing, like, okay, I'm going to test myself, and there's going to be all kinds of problems and areas of, you know, that need to be addressed. Well, that might be true, but don't look at it as a negative thing, but rather as a positive opportunity. What's really being said there is you have an opportunity to examine yourself in light of Christ so that you can be more like him rather than less like him. In John chapter 3, verse 20, if you turn there with me, John chapter 3 and verse 20, this is Jesus talking, and he says some pretty potent things about this testing of ourselves and examining ourselves. John chapter 3 and verse 20, he says, for everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light so that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought or made in God. You don't have to like the process of being exposed and being confronted with the reality of your own situation. But the alternative is simply unacceptable. The alternative of remaining in darkness and crossing your fingers and hoping that better things will happen, that's just not acceptable and, in fact, is ruinous. Secondly, you have to use the Word as a standard and not yourself, not your parents, not your peers, not your friends, not your personal preferences, not your culture. You can't look around at things that other people are doing and say, yeah, but they're doing it, so that justifies or rationalizes my doing it. You can't do that because they are not an approved standard to begin with, if indeed they're not following Christ. The Word is your standard. And if you use that word rightly, I want to emphasize the word rightly here, if you judge yourself rightly by that standard, then you're not going to be judged or condemned by God. So there's an opportunity then to escape this condemnation or to escape this negative perspective here. If you evaluate yourselves according to what God says and do well, then there's no fear of that condemnation. But if you evaluate yourself or if I evaluate myself by my own standard, it doesn't really matter how it comes out because my standard is inferior and unacceptable. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 18, Paul says it very bluntly. It is not he who commends himself that is approved, but he whom the Lord commends. So I'm asking you, do you commend yourself in your marriage? Do you look at yourself and say, I think I've got a pretty rock-solid marriage. I'm a great husband or a great wife. That's nice. Except, does the Lord agree with you? And can we take your marriage and put it up to the Scripture and find consistency or contradiction? And if you say that you're a great parent, well, that's great. I hope that you are. And I hope that you're striving to be. But is that your measurement or is that God's? Or can we take your parenting and measure that up next to the Word here, and will we find consistency or contradiction? And in the case of contradiction, do you have the courage, the moral courage, to change your ways in light of that? Need to start addressing specifically what needs to be changed and why it needs to be changed. Some people think that any kind of change is good, and that's just not true. Not all change is good. You can actually change for the worse. Or you can change in such a way that is just as disastrous as the way you were on. Just because you're changing doesn't mean anything by itself. The question is, how are you changing and what direction are you going in that change? Are you addressing that at all? Don't do something because, well, the preacher said this, and therefore I have to do it, or he made me feel really guilty, and therefore I have to. That's not good enough reason. My job here is not to make you feel guilty anyway. My job here is to remind you what the Word says. You're going to do with that what you will anyway. Instead, what you should say is, I want to please God, but I cannot please Him if I knowingly refuse what He has said for me to do. or if I knowingly refuse the direction that he leads me in, if I resist that knowingly, consciously, deliberately, how in the world can that be pleasing to God all at the same time? James chapter 4, verse 17, he says, therefore, to him who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. So it's wrong either way. If you do what you know is wrong, well, then that's sin. And if you fail to do that which is right, well, then that's sin too. You say, well, there's just no way out. Yes, there is. Do the right thing, and it will be well with you. And finally, put those changes into effect. Stop talking and start acting. I'm not saying you're just talking, any one of you. This is not a personal statement. But if indeed there's anyone here that is just talking about how great their Christian life is to themselves or to anyone else, and it just doesn't show, it's just not borne out by the word, you need to stop talking and start acting. And this is not a challenge from me, the preacher. This is a challenge from God himself. Matthew chapter 21, verse 28 through 32. Won't go into the parable here, but you can read it on your own. Here's a parable where the father has two sons, and he sends the first one out into the vineyard, and the son says, I will not go. And then he has a change of heart, and he says, okay, but I'll go after all. And he turns to his second son and says, will you go out and work in the land there? And the son says, I will go. And then he reneges on that and says, I will not go. And Jesus' point about that second son is that that son, despite his promise, did not do the will of the Father. And that's a message to us. It doesn't matter that you say, I will, at one time or even presently. It matters as to whether you're going to follow through with what you said you will do. And I hope that you will follow through with that. In Psalm 119, verse 1 and 2, here's an attitude I hope that emulates all of us. I would like to think that all of us are striving for this, where the psalmist says, how blessed are those whose way is blameless, who walk in the law of the Lord. How blessed are those who observe his testimonies, who seek him with all their heart. I hope that that's your endeavor. I hope that that defines you and your resolve. I hope that that defines how you consider the Lord. This ought to be our attitude toward God and his word. The question really is that your attitude? And especially in the realms that we're talking about, in marriage and in family, is that your attitude? God is not going to hold you or me responsible for things outside of our control. And we cannot control our spouses or our grown children. They are adults, and they're going to ultimately do what they will. You only have so much control over them at all. And yet this message really is not for those people anyway. This message, as I said last week, is for you. And this message is for you to be responsible for that which is within your control. And you are always responsible for yourself. Don't ever try the blame game or the finger pointing or the excuse making about how someone else caused you to not be faithful or not be a good wife or a good husband or whatever it might be. Because you are responsible for yourself, and that's all that God is holding you responsible for is yourself. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't help others. It just means that when it's all said and done, each person bears his own load. However, we cannot honor God separate and apart from how we regard the stewardships and the responsibilities that he has entrusted to us. In other words, you can't say, well, I worship my Lord, and yet your marriage is failing through your own irresponsibility and neglect. Or you cannot say, I worship God and I hold him in highest esteem, and yet through your own irresponsibility and neglect, you are failing as a parent. In other words, don't hold those two things separately, like, here's my spiritual life, at least that's intact. It just so happens that I'm a neglectful and irresponsible spouse or parent. You realize that those are two incompatible things. And if you really do hold God highly in your life, then that will directly be reflected and manifested in how you marry and how you parent. And sometimes we just don't see that. If you're not the parent you ought to be, and you're okay with that, then you realize that you're just feeding your children to Satan. And you're okay with that. How in the world is that an honor to God? In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10 through 13, if you turn with me there, Ephesians chapter 6. Here's that old saw, right? About the armor of God and how we're supposed to put on each piece. And people have heard lessons on this probably all their lives. And it becomes a tired old refrain, right, to some, because we're just so familiar with it. I want you to refamiliarize yourself with this in light of what we are saying here. Verse 10, finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. Put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, because that is true, take up the full armor of God so that you will be able to resist in the evil day, and having done everything, to stand firm. There's no doubt we all know this passage. The question is, are you taking this seriously? As we said, there is a war going on, and Satan is in control of that war. I'm not saying he's in control of the entire world or that he has control to determine the outcome. What I'm saying is that in his mind, and as far as anyone follows him, he is in control. And are you taking that seriously? And are you teaching your children to take this seriously, teaching them how to put on this full armor? Are they watching you from your own example? Are you putting it on yourself piece by piece and then training your children how to do the same thing? So that's the question we need to ask ourselves. Am I doing this? It's not enough that the instruction is there. It's necessary that we follow the instruction. The war on the family is real. It is in progress as we speak. It is taking its toll against the nation and, yes, against every church. And we must not fall over backward as a bunch of hapless and helpless casualties. We can't shrug and go, what's a person to do? At least I am secure, right? Be strong in the Lord means far more than show up for services. It means far more than just success by association. Like, you know, your life's kind of a mess, but at least you hang around successful people, and so some of that's going to rub off, and, you know, you're going to kind of fly into the through the pearly gates on the coattails of someone else. No, you're not. It's not going to work that way. I hope that the good and godly influence of those people does have a positive effect on you, if that's you. But you realize that you have to be personally responsible. And if you will not put on the full armor of God, then you are going to succumb to the enemy. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. And the more adults who succumb to the enemy, the more likely their children will succumb, and the more likely their children will succumb, and this simply cannot be acceptable to us. The good news is, if you do find your strength in the Lord and do put on that full armor, if those things are true, then Satan cannot destroy you. Doesn't mean he will not assault you. Doesn't mean he won't try, but he cannot harm you. Stand firm is mentioned three times in this passage, Ephesians 6, verse 10 through 14. Stand firm means, in essence, know what your objective is and put full confidence in God's ability to help you. Because you and I are no match for Satan. We are not prepared to, nor do we have the ability to take him head on. He is stronger than we are, but he is no match for Christ. And if you believe that, then you put your confidence in Christ to take care of Satan's advances and assaults against you instead of trying to do it on your own. And if you don't believe that, then it will be evident in your marriage, in your family, and in your participation in the church. Don't think otherwise. It will be evident. We will see it. Philippians chapter 2, verse 15 through 16. Prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God, above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life. Well, if this isn't a crooked and perverse generation, after all that we've talked about, I don't know what is. And it's not getting better. It's getting worse. And so that doesn't mean it's going to get easier for you. That means it's going to get harder, which means that you can't put less effort and attention into this matter. You have to put more. Are you up for that? Are you willing to do that? Have you committed to that? Are you putting on the full armor of God? And does this passage describe you? Lots more to say. Our time is over for this morning. But we'll continue on our series here. And not only to point out the things that need to be addressed, but also to offer some solutions to that as well. If there's anyone here this morning that is subject to our invitation, as we traditionally offer at the end of our lessons, an opportunity for you to respond by coming forward if you need to, then we invite you to do so as we stand and sing the song that Richard has selected for us.